I was preparing this talk, I tried to come up with a joke on the Book of Changes, this major subject on which I will be talking today. But I really realized quite quickly that it's rather difficult to joke about the Book of Changes, because as you probably all know, it's quite a serious book, and it's a very book with a huge and rather, yeah, rather like, yeah, with a huge authority, and so we all know this, at least sinologists all know this famous wish by Confucius, in which he says that when he's older, he will study, or when he will be older, then he will study the Book of Changes. So as we all are rather young, we should come up with other reasons to study the Book of Changes. So I try in my talk to give you some reasons to read the Book of Changes and discover it again. So the title of my talk is Confucian Divination and the Contingency of Community, on two types of Ursprungsdenken in Mosungsan and Wanghui. And I will just read my written version. So, do Chinese-speaking people, when they deliberate about actions or life plans today, still draw on the resources of their pre-modern cultural, philosophical, and religious traditions? And more particular, do the various techniques of divination and divinatory knowledge still hold action-guiding force over Chinese-speaking people today? We are not necessarily in a position to take a decision on this issue, for various diagnostic claims compete with each other. On the one hand, with the advent of modernity, the normative claims of divinatory knowledge have been challenged on all sides, especially by the Chinese Communist Party, which denounced and still denounces all kinds of divinatory practices as superstition, mixin. Thus, many Chinese consider divinatory knowledge as nothing than meaningless relics of the past. On the other hand, we are witnessing today not only a Confucian revival, and here I use Sebastian Biu's term, but also a broader re-emergence of traditional ways of believing, of divinatory and religious practices, life coping strategies, and other very deeply seated cultural elements. Thus, we cannot but conclude that the contemporary mindset of the Chinese-speaking people, and here I am not only thinking of the People's Republic of China, but also of Hong Kong, Singapore, and Taiwan, is still influenced to some extent by the background of pre-modern Chinese culture that took shape long before the encounter with the West. But what does this mean? It is well known that the Book of Changes, I Ching, is the most important book on divination and prognostication in Chinese civilization. It combines religious and philosophical perspectives, and its influence on all spheres of Chinese life can hardly be overestimated. Numerous scholars have claimed that the Book of Changes describes a very particular mode of thought characteristic for Chinese people, namely a monistic view of the cosmos and the self, a worldview that recognizes only events, no entities, a worldview that emphasizes change and the natural process, that also willingly admits the fluidity of life and classifies all experiences and phenomena as complementary. Furthermore, the Chinese mindset, as determined by the Book of Changes, it is said, is supposed to synthesize numerous contradictions. For example, the contradiction between necessity and freedom, time and eternity, change and immobility. All this is said to constitute the very otherness of Chinese thinking, its processual, immanent, holistic, spontaneous, organic nature. This is also, according to scholars like A.C. Graham, Roger Ames, and François Julien, the very difference between Chinese thought on the one hand and the so-called Greek way of thinking on the other hand. However, beyond these often heard characterizations, which all too easily turn into cliché, it is extremely difficult to specify the nature and the validity of this particular mode of thought. For example, I do not know what to make of the claim that the processual logic of the Book of Changes is still recognizable in Mao Zedong's famous treatise on contradictions. This claim has been made. Is this a convincing claim? And is it plausible to think, as the German sociologist Oskar Nicht seems to think, that the, and here I quote Nicht, principle of flexible work and the organic qualitative time structure of process thought, Prozessdenken, still determines social practices in post-communist China? And is it even possible, as François Julien thinks, that French university professors, while sitting in the offices in Paris and probably nipping some espresso or some cafe, that these professors can think and act successfully in accordance with the Book of Changes. Isn't it just anachronistic pretense that modern agents, under the conditions of secular societies, can rely on such an ancient worldview? Don't we all agree on the fact that in modernity, human agency asserts itself independent from any external or natural standard, relying merely on the scientific modes of knowledge, which proceed by the means of probability, not of fate, and which also in general tend to avoid prognostications? At this point, it becomes rather obvious that we need to understand better the relationship between modern social practices and the worldview of the Book of Changes. In the following, I want to focus on what I call Confucian divination, namely the adaptation of central tenets which can be found in the Book of Changes by Neo-Confucian scholars and their contemporary interpretations. In order to do so, I will proceed in four steps. First, I will briefly introduce two important Chinese thinkers, namely Mo Zongsan and Wang Hui, who both claim that the origin of Chinese modernity, including its social and political practices, is somehow to be located in the age of Neo-Confucianism, that is in the 11th and 12th century. Second, I will then spend a few minutes on the history of the Book of Changes, its reception in the Song Dynasty, that is during the height of Neo-Confucianism. And then third, I will analyze the interpretations of the Neo-Confucian notion of Ming, in Mo Zongsan, and fourth, in Wang Hui. And finally, I will develop some preliminary thoughts on this whole story, centering on the issue of human agency, the question of freedom, and the Chinese political community. My analysis is rather preliminary and in many aspects still rather tentative, and it is an exploration of a few but very central tenets held by these thinkers. And I think we need much more research before we can think of fully evaluating their theoretical claims. At least within the academic field of Chinese philosophy in China or Taiwan, the pairing of Mo Zongsan and Wang Hui appears on its face inaccurate. For Wang Hui, many scholars would contend, is not a true philosopher, but merely a defender of a left-leaning project of neo-traditionalism, which is at best an example of intellectual history and at worst wholly anti-democratic and authoritarian. On the contrary, Mo Zongsan is seen by many, especially by his most faithful devotees, as an upright Confucian scholar who, under the harsh conditions of authoritarian rule of the Kuomintang in Taiwan, attempted to anticipate liberal democracy. A thinker who not only appreciated and understood Kant, Immanuel Kant, but also reconciled the Kantian understanding of autonomy and equality with the Chinese intellectual traditions, and who therefore gave birth to the most authentic, the only modern reinterpretation of Neo-Confucian texts still possible. However, as I want to argue in the following, we actually have good reason to compare these two thinkers and their respective grand narratives of Chinese modernity. Admittedly, there are quite a few differences between these thinkers that need to be taken seriously. Most obviously, Mo Zongsan and Wang Hui developed their respective systems of thought under very different historical conditions. Wang Hui is a contemporary representative of the Chinese New Left, and as such interested in rethinking and to some extent even defending the particular experience of Chinese communism. In contrast, Mo Zongsan, who was exiled from mainland China in the late 40s, and used to live at the margins of the Chinese world during most of the second half of the 20th century, was a fervent anti-communist and sought to anticipate a future democratic, but at the same time Confucian China. Mo Zongsan is clearly taking his distance from Hegel and Marx, who were both extremely popular among Chinese intellectuals at his time. His deepest ambition is nothing less than saving Confucianism by the means of Kantian metaphysics and moral theory. Wang Hui, par contre, goes well beyond Kant and adopts key concepts from Hegel and Marx, such as historical force, struggle, recognition, and dialectic, in order to construct a historical and also critical genealogy of Chinese modernity, which, to some extent, rivals the narratives of contemporary Hegelians like Alasdair MacIntyre Charles Taylor, or in Germany, Axel Honneth. Wang Hui's deepest ambition, and here I quote the literary historian Qian Lichun, seems to be to provide a justification, both historical and theoretical, for the model of China's recent success. What exactly this success consists of, and whether it really is a success, is of course debatable. Another important difference between these two thinkers is that while Mo, at least on the surface, is merely preoccupied with exegesis and commentary, Wang Hui is best understood as a historian cum intellectual activist whose historical narrative concerning the emergence of Chinese modernity could be classified with some reason under the traditional genre of historical criticism. The goal is to make a moral point, meaning that Wang advances normative considerations through the analysis of historical facts, developments, and events, culminating in his new definition of Chinese modernity. But these differences, I want to claim, are less important than certain commonalities. In particular, I want to emphasize three commonalities. First and foremost, both Mo Zongzhen and Wang Hui are examples of modernization discourses or narratives of Chinese modernity. Both Mo and Wang are convinced that the project of Chinese modernity cannot be fully understood and even cannot be realized without taking into account the historical and philosophical horizon of 11th and 12th century Neo-Confucianism. It needs to be pointed out at this point that Mo Zongzhen published his magnum opus, the Xinti Yu Xingti, Constitutive Heart, Mind and Nature, as it has been translated, in the late 60s. In other words, on the height of the Cultural Revolution. Thus, Mo Zongzhen was attempting to defend the Neo-Confucian tradition precisely at the historical moment when this tradition was found by most Chinese to be a dead end. Now it is in fact quite stunning to see how Wang Hui, who is a Chinese leftist, takes up a series of arguments from Mo Zongzhen about Neo-Confucianism in his seminal book, The Origin of Modern Chinese Thought. And here I show you these two books. And second, both thinkers attempt to renegotiate Chinese modernity by the means of philosophical language of Neo-Confucianism, which is deeply influenced by the divinatory, religious, and philosophical discourse of the Book of Changes. At the same time, both thinkers locate the historical origins in the 11th and 12th century, that is, at the height of Neo-Confucianism, which also means that both thinkers draw quite selectively on traditional sources while creating new and often very Hebraic concepts and theoretical perspectives. And then third, probably my most important point, what I also want to underline is the fact that both Mo and Wang use a very particular understanding of practice, in Chinese, 实践, in their respective articulation of Neo-Confucian ideas. In Mo's case, this is moral practice, the moral agent, the practice of them by the moral agent. And in Wang's case, this is social practice, aiming at social equality. It is obviously true that Neo-Confucian teachings make an essentially practical point, meaning that they are concerned with practices of self-transformation and self-cultivation, but also with other moral and social practices, much more than with pure theory. Actually, this point has been made a long time ago by the German sinologist Werner Eichhorn. In his monograph on Zhou Dunyi, one of the key Neo-Confucian thinkers, he insists that Neo-Confucian thought, and even Chinese thought in general, is closely related to social and political practice. That is what he calls its sociological dependence, soziologische Gebundenheit in German. And actually, many pre-modern Chinese thinkers do in fact want us to look to our own practice, not to some rather abstract theoretical perspective. All this rigorously grounds philosophy in political, social, and ritual reality. Now, it seems quite plausible to argue that some of these Neo-Confucian beliefs, even today, are widely shared social properties which still function as individually inherited standards for action and deliberation in contemporary China. And Mo Zongzhen and Wang Hui, or at least this is my impression, attempt to transform these practices into conceptual language, which serves them to circumscribe and even to criticize the Western conceptual space. For example, Mo Zongzhen boldly declares that Chinese people have never valued theoretical reason very highly. This is one of his very famous arguments, and is of course a critique of Western philosophy and of Western modernity in general. Similarly, Wang Hui argues against the use of Western concepts in the analysis of Chinese reality, since China represents some sort of singularity. I think we have to analyze carefully and also cautiously the respective narratives and then see what to make of them. Now, generalities aside, let me now summarize their most basic claims as follows. Both Mo Zongshan and Wang Hui claim that the self-relation of political and moral actors in the Chinese world today cannot be understood apart from their relation with the traditional pre-modern worldview, which refers in particular to the divinatory, religious, and philosophical language of the Book of Changes and its transformation by Neo-Confucian scholars during the 11th and 12th century. To be more specific, both thinkers are concerned with the conditions of human agency, with the dialectic relationship between freedom and necessity, self-assertion and fate. Second, concepts such as fate, decree, endowment, these are different translations for the same Chinese term, ming, inner nature, xing, propensity of things, shi, and time, or better, timeliness, shi, play a crucial role in their respective theoretical projects. Both projects draw, although rather selectively, on certain texts of the Neo-Confucian tradition, and particularly on the Book of Changes and its most famous canonical commentary, the commentary on the appended phrases, Xi Zi Zhuan. And finally, both favor some sort of alternative Chinese modernity in which the more or less faithful adherence to traditional practices and norms plays a seminal role. Now I come to my second part, the overview of the history of the Book of Changes. Not many pre-modern Chinese texts lend themselves to such a variety of interpretations and uses as the Book of Changes. The Book of Changes is often read as a book of wisdom, particularly in the West, of course, due to Richard Wilhelm's contribution as a translator. And you may also know Sigi Jung's famous theory of synchronicity. It is fairly obvious that one central concern of the Book of Changes is to understand and control fate. In other words, it has often been read as a divinatory manual, as if it were possible to obtain from it direct prognosticative judgments, such as your husband will die soon, or you should marry the son of your older daughter. And maybe you have all heard of this kind of prognosticative judgments. The classic definition of divination given in the Zhuozhuan is that it is to resolve doubts, Juyi. Therefore, the Book of Changes appear to be a manual by the means of which the skillful diviner is able to fully understand a particular situation and derive from his or her understanding accurate prediction of future situations, thereby helping people to resolve doubts. But the details of this story are much more difficult to understand. And meaningful, clear, and accessible discussions of the Book of Changes in Western languages are hard to come by. For although it sometimes seems to directly suggest actions, for example, in hexagram number 39, advantage will be found in the southwest and the contrary in the northeast, the Book of Changes in general lacks the determinacy necessary for immediate use. It requires intense hermeneutic effort to understand its hidden advice and vague predictions. Now, the earliest layers of the Book of Changes probably date from the late Shang and early Zhou dynasty, and its original project supposedly was one of technical divination and prognostication, and the use of milfoil stalks is the divinatory technique best known. But this original project changed over the centuries and was transformed into a much more complex endeavor. Beginning with the Han dynasty and at latest with Wang Bi, the commentaries concerned with the Book of Changes were far less centered on the technical aspects of divination than in earlier centuries. And they call this a process of philosophization of the Book of Changes. Thus, the Book of Changes was transformed from a technical manual into a Confucian classic for universal moral guidance. The concrete surface of the original text, including the 64 hexagrams, was increasingly complemented with various layers of philosophical, religious, ritual, political, literary meaning, until the Book of Changes had become an all-encompassing system of knowledge, a multi-layered text which was also thought to represent the final account about the order of things. And I think due to time constraints, I have to jump a little bit. And yeah, maybe I just directly jump to the final lines of this passage, this part. In other words, here I summarize my analysis. The goal of understanding future actions is only one aspect of a much more comprehensive undertaking. The reader of the Book of Changes, it is hoped, shall discover the hidden order of the world behind its apparent meaninglessness and understand the situational potential of his or her present. To some extent, the activity of reading becomes more important than divinatory techniques in the Song Dynasty. And here you might remember that Stefan Feuillaz, in his recent reading class, a reading session, has made a very similar point. In other words, reading the Book of Changes during the Song Dynasty is less about predicting the future than about interpreting and understanding correctly the structure of the human mind and the cosmos. Without a doubt, all this is certainly based on a rather optimistic understanding of human existence and the cosmos. And we should also keep in mind that the Book of Changes not only deeply influenced the political discourse and the self-understanding of cultural elites in Imperial China, but that political actions were often directly justified with reference to particular passages in the text. Now I come to my third part, the interpretation of the Neo-Confucian notion of Ming in Mao Zedong. In the 20th century, the exegesis, the whole mindset of the Book of Changes, is taking on new forms of expression. Without a doubt, in their respective writings, Mao Zedong and Wang Hui articulate echoes from the past, for both are committed to the view, as I've already said, that the resources of modernization are to some extent endogenous to China. The emergence of modernity was not hindered by Neo-Confucianism, but rather normatively required, as Mao claims, or somehow critically accompanied, as Wang claims, by Neo-Confucian ideas. As I understand him, Wang Hui essentially advances an argument of historical continuity, by which he wants to clarify certain causal processes. The first elements of global capitalism took shape during the 11th and 12th century. Neo-Confucian teachings were at the same time reflecting this early modernization process while also challenging it, criticizing it, trying to contain its negative consequences. And in contrast, Mao Zedong, with the help of Kantian categories, directly transforms Neo-Confucian teachings into a purely philosophical language, which then serves him to describe and even justify the modern project in China. Now, as I've said before, Mao Zedong is quite a famous philosopher in 20th century China, and he's often called a Confucian Kantian, which is of course a rather hybrid way of characterizing a philosopher. His oeuvre is immense, and his writings seem deep, often mind-boggling. In the following, I want to focus my attention on one particular issue which takes center stage, both in Mao's book, Xin Ti Yu Xing Ti, The Constitutive Heart, Mind, and Nature, and in his treatise on the Summum Bonum, Yuan Shan Lun. However, it needs to be stressed that Mao, very early in his intellectual career in the years after 1928, when he studied philosophy at Peking University, read the Book of Changes, and both in the Book of Changes and in Alfred North Whitehead's Process and Reality, which he was reading at the same time, he discovered a shared vision of cosmos and selfhood. Now, at this point of my lecture, a few words need to be said on the original Neo-Confucian notion of Ming. For the sake of brevity, I want to concentrate on the contribution of one Neo-Confucian scholar, namely Zhu Xi, whom I have already mentioned, and I hope my whole account does not become too complex at this moment. In the context of the EKGF, Richard J. Smith has given a very detailed presentation on the rich semantic field of Ming. Thus, I do not want to go into too technical details today. And you might consult the website of the EKGF and look at this paper. To joke, and now finally a joke, the difficulty with the concept of Ming is that it is not a concept. It is rather stands for a particularly vast and dynamic, but also rather ambiguous semantic field. As such, it oscillates between the meanings of fate, destiny, decree, mandate, and endowment. And now you can have a look at my PowerPoint. First and foremost, there is the famous beginning of the practice of the mean, the Zhongyong, which sinologists at least are supposed to know, Tianming Zi Wei Xing, which directly connects the individual dimension of mean, here I'm speaking about this, on the left, to the transpersonal cosmic dimension of Ming on the right here, the Tianli. as something which reflects the cosmic order and which therefore is also meaningful and needs to be accepted as such. In Zhuxi's writings, we find a series of equivalents for Ming. For example, Tian Ming and Xing Ming, but also the very famous and very ambiguous term of Li, or derivated terms like Tian Ming Zi Xing or Tian Ming Zi Quanti. It also appears in terms describing activities like the famous knowing fate, Zhi Ming, which appears both in the Analects, if I'm not wrong, and in the Mencius, and standing firm on one's fate, Li Ming, but also in less frequent combinations like Ding Ming, Ming Fen, and Fen Ding. I shall spare you the translation of these terms, since it is rather difficult to translate them into plain English, and it would take too much time to explain the respective semantic fields. But it needs to be pointed out that for Zhuxi, all these terms are deeply interwoven. And this is also the reason why Zhuxi in his commentaries, especially in his commentary to the four books, the Si Shu Zhang Ju Ji Zhu, which was to become the most important textbook for state exams in pre-modern China, makes all the different uses of Ming blend into one another. He also quotes a lot of texts which were important to the Neo-Confucian tradition, in particular the Great Learning, the Da Xue, the Doctrine of the Mean, which I already mentioned, the Zhongyong, the Analects, the Mencius, but also, and most importantly, the I Ching, the Book of Changes, and the commentary on the appended phrases, the Xi Chi Zuan. For the modern reader to whom many of these different texts appear to be irreconcilable, now I have a problem with reading here, it is extremely difficult to disentangle the various layers of argument and to disambiguate the numerous semantic fields. But at least from the Neo-Confucian perspective, all these texts and all these different meanings are regarded as expressions of the same way, Dao. Having said this, I hope you allow me now in a lecture on the Book of Changes and Confucian Divination to quote a passage from the book Mencius. And analyzing this passage, I will demonstrate to you what could be called the essential intertextuality of Neo-Confucian arguments. This passage not only contains in a nutshell some of the most important tenets about human agency held by Confucians and Neo-Confucians, but it also plays a crucial role in most modern science interpretation of Neo-Confucianism. The passage is Mencius 7b24. Yeah, probably I don't have to read it out. Please just go through this passage. And I continue. Somehow, Mencius seems to be concerned with the difference between certain biological capacities of human beings and functions, we could also say like eating and seeing, and higher capacities which relate to values and correct behavior. But it's not really clear what the different dichotomy between nature, xing, and decree, ming, stands for in this passage. We can only guess that Mencius wants to make an argument about the extremely complex relation between personal responsibility and some sort of transpersonal, transindividual fate. For Zhuxi, in his commentary, the point seems to be that Mencius wants to encourage us to strive harder and not to regard external things like social and political relations in the second part of this passage as fate, that is something that we cannot change. To the contrary, we should also work hard on these things. And quite paradoxically, in the first part of the argument, Mencius, at least according to Zhuxi's interpretation, wants to encourage us not to think of internal things, that is what is under our control, as too accessible to us. Even here we can observe the working of some sort of fate, that is working of a force which is not accessible and controllable by us. Now let's turn to Mao Zedong's interpretation. For him, much more is at stake in this brief passage. Like Mencius, he also thinks that it's extremely important to know correctly what the content of one's Ming is. But then how can one know one's Ming? In his extensive analysis in the constitutive heart, mind, and nature, Mo first distinguishes between two senses of Ming. There is first the sense of Ming as a limitation, the Ming Xian, and there is second one sense as mandate, order, or decree, Ming Ling. The former is said to refer to the sphere of qi, the sphere of material stuff. This is a very central Neo-Confucian concept. The latter, however, to the sphere of li, that is some higher transcendent sphere, a sphere of values.
Thus, there are two kinds of necessities in Mao Zedong's time. One is the natural necessity, the necessity of being determined by natural laws, and the other is of a higher transcendent necessity, the necessity of freedom, or what I want to call it some kind of spiritual necessity. Obviously, this is not easy to understand. So what exactly is the necessity of freedom? Let us now turn back to our passage from the Mencius. Mao Zedong obviously follows Zhuxi in believing that Mencius wants us to believe in our control, not only over internal things, but also over external things, like social and political relations. That is, both seem to be thinking that it might be possible to somehow extend the realm of spiritual freedom by making an effort by cultivating ourselves. And Mao goes on to further qualify the second dimension of Ming as decree. He analyzes it as some kind of imperative which has great normative pull on us, but which also implies that I am in control. In Chinese, 无所能掌握者, of the situation or action, that is, I am active. Or to put it into more Kantian terms, only because I know that I'm obliged to do so, I also know that I am free. Obviously, there is a dialectical relation between control and necessity on the one hand, and freedom and responsibility on the other hand. And furthermore, I think there is a very obviously a religious dimension to this kind of spiritual necessity. Ulf Lehmann, a German scholar, has found the following very felicitous formulation for the second meaning of Ming. The very reality of fate is nothing but the Anlass der Transzendenz, as he calls it, the occasion for transcending necessity, or maybe even transcending the social and political world. Only by following the decree of Li, that is the order sent out to us by the sphere of values, we are able to somehow transcend the sphere of natural laws and realize our spiritual freedom. And we can understand this vision better if we focus for a minute on the very concrete experience Mao Zedong is describing in his philological analysis. On this level, I want to claim the notion of Ming represents, and here I quote again Ulf Lehmann, the limitation of individual subjective arbitrariness or insight. Limitation of arbitrariness means that I cannot act as I or my empirical self, my desires, my emotions want to act. I am hindered by something which is not under my control, which is not available to me, but which is also necessarily external to myself, which is also not necessarily external to myself. And limitation of insight refers to my limited knowledge of my situation and of my own self. And quite paradoxically, it is the presence of my innate endowment. You remember this meaning of Ming, Ming as innate endowment. It is this presence which implies that I will never be able to fully understand completely the various conditions of my existence. Now, to make a very long point a little more briefer, I will turn to this paragraph, because I just said that I wanted to explain the intertextuality of Neo-Confucian texts to you. So I now jump from the Mencius, which obviously plays a crucial role in Mao's argument on freedom and necessity. I directly jump to the Book of Changes, to this Wenyan commentary to the first hexagram, which some of you might know. And I read it out. Mao Zedong directly quotes this text in his book. The great man is someone whose virtue is consonant with heaven and earth, his brightness with the sun and the moon, his consistency with the four seasons, and his prognostications of the auspicious and inauspicious with the workings of gods and spirits. When he precedes heaven, heaven is not contrary to him. And when he follows heaven, he obeys the timing of its moments. Since heaven is not contrary to him, how much less will man or gods and spirits be? It is this cosmic vision which we tend to neglect when translating Confucian texts and analyzing their Neo-Confucian interpretations. And it's now, I don't have the time to show this, but yeah, if you have time to read my paper later on, you will realize that Mao, by a very tricky, very typical Chinese technique of exegesis, is linking these two texts, the Mencius passage, which we have just read, and this passage in the Book of Changes. And he thereby makes the claim that this cosmic vision, the vision, this kind of the unity between the individual being and heaven and earth, is basic or essential to human agency, as Mencius describes it. So maybe, this I just skip, and I make this final summary of my interpretation of Mosung San. To many of us, Mosung San must appear to be a religious thinker who at the same time tries to reconceptualize the very modern and also very Western idea of self-assertion by the means of Neo-Confucian texts. The idea of the subject is seminal to his philosophical account. However, he also constantly weakens the independence of the individual by reference to some broader cosmic order. And this is exactly what Neo-Confucianism was about. In Theodore de Berry's words, to find the unifying thread, the balanced mean, the underlying value, or all-embracing conception remains the fundamental aim of Neo-Confucian teachings. And this is, of course, a very holistic understanding of the world and of the self. We need to say it clearly. This very holistic nature of the Neo-Confucian discourse, according to which each particular thing contains in itself the infinitude of the whole cosmos, runs against the modern process of differentiation and the emergence of independent spheres of politics, morality, culture, society, aesthetics, etc. Admittedly, Mosung San sometimes sounds as if the theory of cosmic unity and hierarchy was nothing but a subjective projection, some sort of subject-centered existentialist or even Heideggerian ontology, as Sebastian Biou reads him. However, in many other passages, Mosung San has still not abandoned the goal of finding the unifying threat behind all phenomena. And the sense of certitude with which the Confucian individual is endowed is certainly, at least partially, due to this broader cosmic framework. Mosung San rarely ever writes about divinatory techniques and the prognostication of future events, but his whole understanding of human existence, moral agency, and even politics, I want to claim, depends largely on the divinatory, philosophical, and religious discourse which we find in the Book of Changes, in particular on the notion of Ming. Now I come to my fourth part. I think I have 15 more minutes, so hopefully I will be able to run to read these passages without overwhelming you with all these Chinese terms and very metaphysical, very mystical ideas. Let me now turn to Wang Hui. It was in 2004 that Wang Hui published his magnum opus, The Rise of Modern Chinese Thought. In the last two decades, China has undergone a revival of Confucianism, and to some extent, Wang's book gives this contemporary constellation another twist. Being a leftist global intellectual, turning to the Confucian and in particular Neo-Confucian tradition of thought, is without doubt quite a paradoxical development. As he himself put it, Wang began his project with a very simple question. 什么是中国? What is China? And then, 什么是中国的现代? What is Chinese modernity? The answer is a huge and extremely ambitious monograph in which Wang, in the aftermath of the so-called New Enlightenment of the 90s, reflects on the historical and normative sources of Chinese modernity. Now, as I have already mentioned, Wang thinks that the origin of Chinese modernity we are facing today, namely the very messy, very confused, very hybrid state of modern consciousness in mainland China, lies in the Confucian past. Once again, it is for this reason that I have proposed in my introduction the term of Ursprungsdenken, the thinking about the origin. Actually, in his fourth volume, Wang Hui makes the following very interesting remark. And now I want to introduce you to at least some passages from this huge book. I don't read the Chinese, and you can, maybe I don't read the English either. You can just go through it quickly. As you all know, if you are familiar with the Book of Changes and certain Taoist texts, the return to the origin of all things does not just refer to a historical or temporal movement, but also to the recovery of a normative ground which was always there, an unchanging, pristine Wei Dao in its immediate presence. Just think of the famous Taoist idea of the Fan Ben in the Tao Te Ching. Thus, Wang's claim is not without some degree of ambiguity. His own theoretical move in his own time seems to reiterate the very return to the origin of these late Qing Dynasty thinkers, like Zhang Taiyan, Yan Fu, Liang Qichao, and others. Like them, he also is convinced that the origin of modern consciousness needs to be located in the 11th and 12th century. In any case, many centuries before the arrival of Western powers and Western ideas in China. And this is not a claim we should easily reject. As I mentioned before, many other thinkers have made similar claims about some sort of early modernity, which has been realized in the 11th and 12th century in China. And you might think here of similar books by Jiang Guanghui or Chen Lai or Yu Yingshi and Zhu Weizheng, and a lot of scholars have written similar books, and in the West, among Western scholars, similar books have appeared. And we also know in Japan there are a couple of Japanese scholars, particularly the scholars belonging to the Kyoto School, have made similar claims. And I don't, as I say again, I don't have the time to really deeply investigate and evaluate these claims. I just mention it. The idea that modernity, in particular Wang Hui is thinking of, I quote him here, formalization of a political system, national identity, division of labor, and long-distance trade has somehow taken shape in the Song Dynasty, long before the arrival of the Europeans. Now, what is the role of Neo-Confucianism in this account? According to Wang, the Neo-Confucian discourse is based on the notion of heavenly pattern, Tianli. Now, you might remember that in my analysis of these semantic fields, this notion already appeared there, down on the right. Tianli, a notion which he sees as, and which is in fact, directly linked with the divinatory logic of Xing Ming and Xing Ming. Furthermore, for Wang Hui, the Neo-Confucian discourse essentially fulfills two functions. To quote one notable passage in his book, which brings us to the heart of Wang's account, the investigation of Li and Wu, that is two key concepts of the Neo-Confucian discourse, was nothing else but the investigation of the sources of critique and emancipation. At the same time, it was also an analysis regarding the normative ground for hierarchical order and control. And this, I think, is the most important sentence I have found in this book by Wang Hui, and it is worth of reflection and analysis. Yeah. In other words, the long history of Neo-Confucianism, very broadly from the 11th century to about the 19th, or some scholars would say the 20th century, was simultaneously revolving around the goals of critique and emancipation on the one hand, and the twofold goal of creating hierarchy and achieving control. That is the ordering of the world, the foundation of a comprehensive political, cultural, and moral order for China. At one place, Wang calls the Neo-Confucian discourse a space used by both the political center, that is the emperor, the court, and the cultural elites, and some parts of the larger population in the Song Dynasty. In Chinese, Gong Yong, Kong Jian. And this is without any doubt a very paradoxical claim. How is it possible that one sort of discourse can be so contradictory? But Wang's book offers rich textual and historical evidence to prove his claim. And I myself find it quite a convincing claim. By critique, Wang is thinking primarily of the very common critique Neo-Confucian scholars have made against the many social inequalities emerging in 11th and 12th century China. And by emancipation, he refers to the individualistic tendencies in Neo-Confucianism, the quest for some sort of moral autonomy, even individualistic freedom. But the idea of individual freedom remains in Wang Hui always linked to the idea of social progress. This is, in a nutshell, Wang Hui's understanding of Neo-Confucianism. Whether this interpretation of Neo-Confucian texts and his analysis of historical reality hold out against detailed critical examination is hard to tell. What I want to emphasize is that Wang Hui's focus on the historical political dimension of the Neo-Confucian discourse fits together in many aspects with the research done by other scholars of Neo-Confucianism. Here I'm thinking particularly of Peter Bohl and Yu Yingshi. What I want to draw attention to in the following is once again the Book of Changes, and especially the notion of Ming. How does Wang interpret this notion, and what line of argument does it connect to? What is in his understanding of human agency, if there is one? Interestingly, Wang once quotes the historian Qian Mu's remark that the Neo-Confucian discourse on Tianli, a notion which originally comes from the Zhuangzi, and the discourse on Xing Ming, which we find in Confucius and Mencius, as I have already said, but also in the Book of Changes, are more or less identical. And this is a very fair description, I think, at least on the level of exegetical practices in the Song Dynasty. But this also means that for Wang Hui, and please have a look now again at my analysis of the various semantic fields related to the notion of Ming, the discourse of Xing Ming, that is inner nature and endowment, is mostly addressed as part of the discourse on Tianli, which is a much more holistic notion, less centered around the issue of individual agency. And here I see an obvious difference between Mo Zongsan and Wang Hui. While Mo is interested in lifting the individual, that is the moral agent, out of the process of social and historical change, Wang is seeing it as part of these changes. At this point, some pieces of Wang's argument remain still unclear to me, I have to admit, and I will have to think through Wang's pages more carefully and in more depth in the future. Still, I want to share the following preliminary observations with you. And due to time constraints, again, I'm not sure whether I should read all these, probably not here. So I, to make a long story again very short, there are other terms, but here, I think we just focus on another passage from this book, The Rise of Modern Chinese Thought, this passage here, again on Tianli. This passage, if you have read it, sounds quite Hegelian, and we can easily become suspicious of the way how Wang Hui wants to gain some kind of normative force for his critique of modernity from the description of such kind of trans-individual historical forces, like the famous Weltgeist of Hegel. Yeah. But as a historical analysis of the very close connection between Neo-Confucian teachings and politics, it is a rather convincing description. And again, we see the same pattern I have already pointed out in the case of Mo Zongsan. The human agent, the locus of the decision-making process, is encouraged to engage with the natural flux of things. There is certainly some notion of autonomy here at work, or some notion of independence of the individual, namely the idea that by engaging with the natural flux of all phenomena, I can also realize some sort of spiritual freedom, transcending the ordinary world. But at the same time, Wang Hui is always coming back to this very holistic notion of heavenly pattern. Therefore, human agents can never become entirely independent of the social and political environment. To sum up the above discussion, for the Neo-Confucian thinkers, in Neo-Confucianism, the necessary conditions of human agency are not located in the singular individual, as many of us think today. There is no idea of a free will that could create new change of causes spontaneously, like Kant would say, but that there is rather this kind of a ontological continuity between self and cosmos, between the inner and the outer. So there is another point I probably don't have time to expand or to explain fully, this issue of hierarchy. And this is also, I would say, one of the more worrying issues in Wang Hui. But we find the same notion of hierarchy in Mo Zongsan as well. If you have ever read Zhu Xi, then you certainly know his idea of Ge Wu Zhi Zhi, investigating things and extending knowledge. This is one very famous, a method of acquiring knowledge in pre-modern China. So Wang Hui thinks that being a new way of moral inquiry, Zhu Xi's theory insists on exploring the moral law through and not with reference to actual hierarchies. This is in Chinese, the Zhi Xu. So, as you might know, the 64 hexagrams of the Book of Changes in themselves embody such a hierarchy. The six lines have often been understood as a metaphor, or better, a direct image of the political and ritual hierarchy at the court, but also in the family, with the highest line occupying the most powerful place. Thus, one way of observing real hierarchies, and thereby understanding what Wang Hui calls the moral law, would be to read the Book of Changes. So in a passage in the famous commentary explaining the trigrams, the shuohua, it is said that, again a quote from the classical Chinese, in the distant past, the way of sages made the changes as follows. It was to be used as a means to stay in accord with the principles of nature and of fate. Xing Ming Zhi Li. Here again we encounter the very puzzling blending of the individual and the trans-individual cosmic dimension of Ming. Now we have I've already spoken for more than 50 minutes, but if you don't mind, I would like to continue for 3 or 4 minutes and read my conclusion. In the final minutes, I want to develop some further thoughts. We easily get the impression that both narratives are essentially religious. But this characterization is rather misleading, since we thereby become entangled in the conceptual dichotomy between religion and secularity, which is characteristic for Christianity, or countries with a Christian or post-Christian cultural background, but not necessarily for China and Chinese-speaking societies. In fact, the social matrix in post-Confucian societies is rather different from the one in Western societies, and many recent studies demonstrate the continuing influence of the traditional non-Western cultural background in social practices in contemporary China. And here I'm thinking in particular of the work by the anthropologist Erika Evadottir on Chinese archaeologists. Her book is called Obedient Autonomy. It came out in 2004. Or also of Michael Lackner's lecture on the Renaissance of Divinatory Techniques in the People's Republic. Now it is once again highly significant that Mosonsan, being a representative of cultural conservatism in 20th century, and Wang Hui being a representative of what is often dubbed the Chinese New Left, concur in believing that modern individuals who think of themselves as belonging to Chinese culture, respectively the citizens of the People's Republic of China, in Wang Hui's case, need to understand themselves with reference to the background of Neo-Confucianism. And without any doubt, the reference to the common background enables Chinese-speaking people to experience their deeds as their very own ones, not as westernized ones. What I have been describing is not part of popular culture, Minjianwenhua, nor does it, strictly speaking, belong to the Renaissance of divination, for both authors are relying quite heavily on Western concepts and theories. Also, Mo and Wang are certainly not merely concerned with developing legitimation strategies of a genuinely Chinese modernity vis-à-vis other modernities. They both try to re-articulate the Neo-Confucian discourse on a philosophical level, thereby also making theoretical and even philosophical or religious claims about human agency. To conceive of the critique of global modernity as religiously inspired would not help us very much in understanding the issues at stake. Now I come to another point, the foundation of the modern Chinese state, very briefly. The implications of Wang Hui's reconstruction of Neo-Confucianism become more evident in the final two volumes of his book. Through a detailed analysis of the two Qing dynasty thinkers, Yan Fu and Zhang Taiyan, Wang goes on to show how the Neo-Confucian holistic mode of thought proved to be extremely influential in the foundation of modern China. First, there is the case of Yan Fu. Wang Hui demonstrates how Yan Fu, through his translation of Thomas Huxley's Evolution and Ethics and John Stuart Mill's classical essay on liberty, not only perpetuated the cyclical view of historical time contained in the Book of Changes, but also developed a quite paradoxical understanding of human agency. On the one hand, Yan Fu emphasized individual freedom and criticized the Chinese traditions. On the other hand, he argued for a rather group-oriented or community-oriented ideal of social harmony, which alone is said to be able to save China against imperialism. In particular, the notion of heavenly pattern, Tianli, directly influences how Yan Fu evaluates the notion of evolution, which he translates as Tianyan, and which plays a very important role in his thought. Although Wang Hui does not spell out this connection explicitly in the rise of modern Chinese thought, it is clear that, for him, the founding of the People's Republic of China was a largely successful attempt to realize Yan Fu's project of modernization. In other words, although he never is frank about this, Wang Hui invokes Neo-Confucian teachings as a means of justifying the governance of the Chinese Communist Party. So maybe I should better say seemingly invokes, because this is a very controversial issue. But if this is true, if he is trying to justify the governance of the Chinese Communist Party, this would be not only a very controversial point, but many would also think this is a rather confused and morally flawed defense of a still very oppressive political regime. But we could also point towards the very real weakness and ultimate untimeliness of Mosonsan's proposal, that is the idea of deriving liberal democracy from Neo-Confucian subjectivity. For the moment being, there is no neo-Confucian theory of democracy available on the market of ideas, which takes into account the experience of liberal democracy in Taiwan, which is the only liberal democracy in the Chinese-speaking world. All we have are highly idealized narratives on Confucian democracy, which do not help us much to understand, not to mention justify, democratic rule in a Chinese-speaking environment. At this moment, some might wonder whether we should try to understand the very real social and political practices in contemporary China or Taiwan by reference to the Book of Changes at all. Might not the whole idea of discussing the modern problem of human agency with reference to Confucian notions be a wrong start in the beginning? To quote the very subtle and very funny, I think, Nathan Sivan on this point, why do people keep asking why the scientific revolution did not take place in China when they know enough not to waste time explaining why their names did not appear on page 3 of today's newspaper? Good question, I think. In fact, there are more than a few people, both in China and Taiwan, who think that any attempt to reconcile the language of Chinese traditions with our contemporary commitments and aspirations towards a free modern life should be abandoned. Instead, what should be done is to subordinate our commitments to traditional belief systems to a public commitment to liberalism, with values like freedom of the press, equal citizenship, the rule of law, and even genuine democracy. Any argument that is culture-based all too easily weakens the force of liberal claims. And now my final paragraph. But there still might be one important point to notice about these neo-Confucian thinkers. Both Monosa and Wanghui, by turning back to the historical horizon of neo-Confucianism, demonstrate their doubts about what we might call rather tentatively the modern project or the Western Enlightenment. This gesture needs to be taken seriously. And it may not be a coincidence that even the rather sober American historian Peter Bowl declares himself, and here I quote Peter Bowl, convinced that Confucianism is much more than a historical subject. It remains the resource for thinking about the present. So this gesture of Monosa and Wanghui speaks of a fundamental doubt about the dynamic idea of progress, of political emancipation, of rationalization, and of technological control, which is actually very common today, not only in China, but also in the West. What Hartmut Rosa in the European context has called the rasender Stillstand, frantic stagnation, is also characteristic for many parts of the life world in Taiwan and China. The continuous mobilization of social and cultural energies with the only goal of economic dynamism and capitalist rationalization is perceived by many as a meaningless project. Modern rational life is characterized by a form of contingency which may undermine modern agents even more radically than the subtle sense of human finitude which we find in the Book of Changes. To many Chinese, and this is my last sentence, the return to the original idea of neo-Confucian agency may appear to be the better choice. Thank you very much.